This is Marathon Training Academy, episode 92.
Welcome to the Marathon Training Academy podcast. I'm Trevor.
And I'm Angie.
In this episode, we'll tell you exactly what you need to know about heart rate training, what can it do for you, and how to get started today. And in this episode's quick tip, we will tell you about the largest online directory of races and running clubs. And if you want to take your running to the next level, head over to our website, marathontrainingacademy.com, and find out about academy membership and personal coaching. So the New York City Marathon was last weekend. So what can you tell us about the marathon in New York City this year?
Well, as most people know, the marathon last year was canceled at the last minute due to Superstorm Sandy and the resulting mess and cleanup there. So this year was a really big year for the marathon. Not only did they, I think, kind of want to prove that, you know, the city could rally together behind the marathon again, but also, you know, with the bombing in Boston this year, they had a lot of security concerns, and the marathon went off really well. It was actually a record high number. I think there were 50,740 official starters.
Wow.
So that's just huge. And, you know, you got to think about all the extra security that has to go into that and all the organization. So it's really a masterpiece of a race. I had a coaching client who ran it. She said that there was so much excitement this year and community support. It just seemed like the whole city really came together and made it a really special day. I believe there were runners from 109 countries, all 50 states, and, of course, D.C. So definitely a big day. This year's winner for the men was Kenyan Jeffrey Mutai in 2 hours, 8 minutes, and 24 seconds. Second place was Ethiopian Sagai Kabidi, and he came in 2 hours, 9 minutes, 16 seconds. And then there was a surprise third place by a little-known South African, Lusafo April. And I guess he kind of wasn't really ranked up there. People didn't expect him to place that well, so that was pretty awesome. And then, of course, Ryan Vale was the top American, finishing 13th in 2 hours, 13 minutes, and 23 seconds. Meb Kifleski, who has been a top marathoner for many years and is now 38, ran with the leaders till about the halfway point, and then he faded to finish 20th. I believe at one point he had to stop and walk because he was really having some pain, but he decided to tough out the marathon and to finish, and he finished in 2 hours, 23 minutes, 47 seconds, I believe his slowest marathon to date.
Oh, man. When I stop and walk, I finish in 4.5 hours.
I know. It's like, you know, any of us would be, like, delighted with that time. But apparently he'd battled a calf injury, and he'd had a fall where he had cut his knee up during his buildup. So wasn't 100%, but still an amazing, amazing finish.
Yes.
By my estimation. The women's winner was Kenyan Priska Jeptu in 2 hours, 25 minutes, and 7 seconds. Ethiopian Buzanesh Diba was second in 2 hours, 25 minutes, and 56 seconds, so pretty close there. And third place was Latvia's Jelena Prokupka, age 37, and she finished in 2 hours, 27 minutes, and 47 seconds. And she was a previous winner, I believe, in 2005 and 2006. The top American woman was Adriana Nelson in 13th, and she was in 2 hours, 27 minutes, and 47 seconds.
So the Americans got 13th. Both for men and women.
Yeah, is that a lucky or an unlucky number, I guess?
I don't know.
Unlucky, maybe. There was also some other neat stories that came out of the marathon. I mean, there were several celebrities who ran for charity this year, like there always are. And I think most notable was Pamela Anderson, who was reported that her longest training run was 12 miles.
Not quite sufficient.
No, but she still managed to finish in 5 hours and 41 minutes, so she obviously has a good baseline of fitness to be able to do that. Olympic swimmer Summer Sanders, she finished in 3 hours, 24 minutes. TV personality Bill Rancic, he started last, and he raised $1 for charity for every runner he passed. So he basically finished in 4 hours, 57 minutes, and I believe he raised around $30,000. So
that's kind of a good idea.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. Carol Mead, the First Lady of Wyoming, finished in 5 hours, 3 minutes. And Jimmy Jensen, age 48, from Los Angeles, was the first runner with Down syndrome to finish the New York City Marathon, and he did it in just under 8 hours.
Right on.
So I thought that was pretty cool. Also, the oldest male finisher was Colin Thorne of New Zealand. He's 89, and he finished in 6 hours, 30 minutes. And the oldest female finisher was Joy Johnson of California. She's 86, and she finished just under 8 hours. And then the news stories reported that the next day she actually passed away.
Yeah, she fell and hit her head.
During the marathon at mile 20.
But wanted to finish. So.
And she, yeah, refused medical attention, went home, or went back to her hotel and, you know, was acting normal, apparently went to see the Today Show the next day, and then she lay down and took a nap that afternoon and didn't wake up. So definitely condolences to her family, but looking back at interviews she has done, it looks like that was probably the way she would like to go. She said she hoped she could run up until the day she died. And actually, it's very interesting that she ran her first marathon at age 59, and she completed about 2 to 3 marathons a year. It was her 25th time running New York City Marathon.
She sounds like a really remarkable woman.
Definitely.
Well, we just want to take a minute and give a congratulations to some members in the Academy who have completed a race recently. Angie, go ahead.
Well, the first one I'd like to mention is also named Angie. She's a coaching client of mine. She finished her first marathon in Des Moines.
Right on.
So congratulations. Another coaching client, Bruno, ran his second marathon in Amsterdam, and he had a PR. He finished in 4 hours and 13 minutes.
Nice.
So also very proud of him. Edith has been battling knee pain and arthritis, and she recently finished a 10K, and she's building back and really still running strong. Joanna finished the Nike Women's Half Marathon after coming back from some injuries. Kathleen became a marathon maniac by running another marathon, and in the process, she set a 40-minute PR.
Wow.
That's pretty exciting. Kim finished a half marathon in Guam, and Mark ran the Marine Corps Marathon, and he got nearly an hour PR. So that's that's pretty epic, Mark. We're proud of you there. Rich finished his first marathon in 4 hours and 18 minutes. Taylor recently ran Marine Corps Marathon, and she's building up to a 50-miler. She's another one of my coaching clients. I'd also like to congratulate Michael and Anna, who both ran the New York City Marathon, and Karen and Amanda both ran their first marathons at the Indianapolis Monumental Marathon. So that's it for now. We're very proud of all these people and all the hard work they've put in, all their accomplishments. I got this email from a listener. It says, "Your podcast has been very motivational. I'm 46 and have been running now for nearly 3 years. I too live in Missouri and am familiar with the challenge of finding events close to home. This Sunday, I'll be running the Spirit of the Osage 50K. I'm extremely excited, for this places me one step closer to my goal of running a 50-miler before I'm 50. I made the transition off grains and sugar a year ago in hopes of staying off medication for bipolar depression. I credit this lifestyle change and running to keeping me stable. It is challenging, but oh so worth it. My favorite long-run fuel is salted mashed sweet potato with butter, coconut oil, and chopped almonds. Thanks for all you do," and that comes from Jan.
Well, thank you for the message, Jan. It's good to hear from a fellow Missourian. And I hope your 50K went well. We're definitely trying to transition off of grains and sugars ourselves, as we've been talking about in the last couple episodes. Angie, are you starting to see results?
Yes, I'm very happy with how it's going. I mean, just the way I feel is the main thing for me. Just, you know, having steadier energy levels, not any blood sugar issues.
Yes.
Fewer cravings. And I'm finally starting to see some progress as far as trimming my stomach area, too. So that's awesome. The second note comes from Eric. He says, "Hi, Angie and Trevor. I just wanted to thank you for putting on a great podcast. It has been extremely helpful and inspirational to listen to as I train for my first marathon. I finished the Twin Cities Marathon in just under 4 hours, and I'm looking forward to my next challenge, possibly a 50K. Keep up the great work, and thanks again."
Wow, so there's another person wanting to do a 50K.
We need to get on the bandwagon.
That's right. We need to do a 50K. So thank you for that message, Eric, and congratulations on finishing the Twin Cities Marathon and using your momentum to start training for 50K. Well, we have some epic content to get into today. We're going to talk about heart rate training. So let's go ahead and jump into that right now. Well on my way, well on my way, well on my way. So right here at the beginning, I'm just going to confess that I don't know anything about heart rate training except for what I've read in your notes. I have a heart rate monitor. It came with my Garmin GPS, but I've never even put it on.
Well, this is definitely the episode for you. Maybe you'll be inspired to try it and see some benefits from it. I think with the continued advances in technology, using heart rate monitors as part of your training has become fairly common. You know, obviously not everyone does, but it's not uncommon for running magazines or coaches to talk about things like VO2 max, lactate threshold, and maximum heart rate.
Right there is where my eyelids start getting heavy.
Okay. I'll have to start poking you every once in a while, huh? There's really so much data available that it can often be confusing and overwhelming to know where to start with this stuff. There's a number of heart rate zone charts and training calculators. And, you know, if you start researching this, it can kind of be dizzying.
There's probably lots of different opinions, too.
Oh, there's lots of different methods. And so it's like, wow, what do you do and how do you narrow it down? And maybe like Trevor here, you have a heart rate monitor and you've never taken it out of the box. Or you know, have tried to use it and you've gotten frustrated because you don't fully understand what's going on with it. So today we want to talk basically about what heart rate training is, some of the common terms that you'll hear related to this topic, benefits of using heart rate monitor training, and whether or not you should consider using it and knowing your various metrics. So obviously we'll try to get you the necessary details without causing your eyes to cross out of sheer boredom. That's for you, Trevor.
Right on.
Because, you know, we don't want to put you asleep while you're running or driving. That could be potentially dangerous.
Yes. We just want to empower you to become a better runner.
Definitely. Now, if you've listened to this podcast since the beginning, you pretty much know that I'm on a need-to-know basis with technology. I'm kind of from the generation that just started using the computer as a teenager and really got familiar with it in college. And I actually didn't get a smartphone until this year. So.
Wait, you said you weren't going to share that.
Oh.
No.
Does that come across as really lame? Sorry. Yes, I had a dumb phone until this year. Now I am smart. Actually, my phone is smarter than me. So anyway, but I ran casually for years without any kind of running watch. And when I ran my first two marathons, all I had was a simple stopwatch from the dollar store. And yes, it only cost $1.
This is how we roll in Missouri, folks.
I actually got it before we moved here, but... So it's possible to do everything really low budget.
Yeah, but that's a really good point because there might be some people listening now that they don't have a technical running watch. They don't have a heart rate monitor. You don't have to.
No, you don't. I mean, the way I estimated distance when I was doing my training runs for my first two marathons is I would drive it in the car and plot my route that way, and then I would go back and run it later. And, you know, I probably wasn't 100% accurate, but... Hey, it worked. And yeah, you know, you can do things on a budget more so. You don't have to have all the latest gear and strain your budget to the max. It's not necessary.
But let me ask you this. If someone doesn't have the latest gear, like let's say they don't own a heart rate monitor today, what are they going to get out of this episode?
Well, I think it's important to, even if you're not currently using that kind of technology, to understand it because you're going to hear people talking about it.
Right.
At some point, you may want to consider using it to get to the next level in running, perhaps, and just, you know, to be able to maybe hold a conversation with someone about these topics and, you know a little bit more about yourself.
Yeah, and hey, Christmas is coming up, so now's the time to determine if you want to get a heart rate monitor and a good, you know, GPS watch and start putting a bug in someone's ear about that.
Yeah, exactly. I've now had a Garmin GPS watch for a few years, but I have to confess that I had a heart rate monitor that I only used like once or twice until recently when I decided, you know, I needed to start playing around with this stuff and experimenting with knowing my personal metrics and things like that. So
now she's using those metrics against me, saying that her heart rate is 10 beats a minute faster when I'm in the house because I add so much stress to the house.
Did I say that? I meant to say that because I was so excited to see you.
Oh, yes.
Right.
Your heart is palpitating because of
your
pure,
good looks and
pure love and romance, right? My good looks.
So maybe you're more beginning runner and you don't have all the fancy stuff, or you're maybe someone who's rebuilding your running base after some time off from running. It's essential that you develop a solid foundation of cardiovascular fitness. But it's really important to start running gradually and train gently so that you can later build on this foundation. A running base is basically a period of time where you develop a solid foundation of cardiovascular fitness, you know, slowly building up your heart, your lungs, your blood vessels to adapt to the increased workload. And you'll also be strengthening and challenging your muscles, bones, and joints during this time. Never try to skip this process because the end result of running a half or full marathon will be much more successful if you do it properly. And one reason why runners get discouraged in the beginning is that they try to run too fast. The best way to know the correct easy pace to train at is by monitoring how the body responds to the effort. you may have heard the advice to run at a conversational pace. So this means that you should be able to carry on a conversation or speak fairly naturally without becoming too short of breath if you're at the right pace. So you can do this talk test periodically during training runs as a good test to see if you're at the appropriate pace. There's going to be a time for harder effort during races and speed training, but if you're short of breath and your heart is beating hard and fast, you're probably running too fast for training. I've even done this when I'm out running alone, so I'm like having this conversation with myself, you know. Or there's also, I've heard, if you can sing the Brady Bunch song while you're running, that mm-hmm. you're at the appropriate pace.
You so can if imagine. If you don't know that. What the Brady Bunch song is, you'll have to go Google it.
Yeah. Learn that and sing it during your easy runs. If you can sing it without gasping for air or being too short of breath, then you're probably at the right pace.
And one of the most annoying songs ever written will be stuck in your head all day.
Exactly. What could be better than that?
Don't you hate that when a stupid song, like a song off one of the kids' movies, stuck in your head?
Yes, I'm sure all parents have suffered from that at some point or another. So one of the first scientists to study and observe how athletes could predict how hard they were exercising was a man named Gunnar Borg.
Is this guy a real person or like a sophisticated marathon cyborg?
Real person.
Okay. Just thought I'd ask.
He noticed that there was a close relationship existing between your exercising heart rate, the intensity of the exercise, and the athlete's perceived effort. And so this led to the rating of perceived exertion. It's also, you can see it abbreviated, RPE. And from this research, he developed the Borg scale, which is basically a scoring system from 6 to 20 based on how the athlete feels. And his advice was to rate your intensity honestly and don't try to be brave. So, you know, if you just had a hard run and you didn't want to, oh, it wasn't too bad, you know, he really wanted you to stick to how you truly felt. It was also found that the Borg scale correlates closely with the heart rate. So let's say you're a 7 on the Borg scale, times that times 10, and that would be approximation of your heart rate, so 70 beats per minute. The Borg scale has since been updated because it's been around for a while, and it now takes into account the fact that your perception of effort does not increase in a strictly linear fashion. So, you know, it's not a predictable pace, basically. The new Borg scale reduces the range of ratings to describe mild to moderate exercise from a scale of 0 to 3, and then it increases the range of heavy exercise from 4 to 10. So, for example, on the new Borg scale, a rating of 0 would be no exercise at all. A 1 would be, you know, something very weak, like a very, very slow walk. 2 would be weak. 3 would be moderate. 4 would be somewhat strong. 5 would be strong or heavy. 7 would be very strong. And 10 would be, you know, very, very strong, like a near maximal effort. So you can kind of use this scale during your training runs and even record in your running log what your perceived effort was. And I actually use this with one of my coaching clients. I just, for her runs, you know, if it's like an easy day, I'll tell her I want it to be an RPE of 3 to 4. So, you know, because sometimes you can just kind of fall back on this set pace and pretty soon your supposedly easy run has turned into a more moderate run. And we'll talk about that a little bit later too.
So the Borg scale, Angie, it sounds like, is still useful. And actually, it was like sort of a foundation for scales that were developed later, and the whole heart rate training concept sort of built on that.
Definitely. There was a lot of research that's been done since that time, and it's really held up well over time.
So now let's talk about how to use heart rate monitors in your marathon training.
Sounds good. One widely known method of determining effort is to monitor your heart rate. Now, you've probably been taught or you've heard that formula of 220 minus your age equals your maximum heart rate. This is now considered to be a very rough estimation, and it's probably not very scientifically accurate. So I want to talk about some more accurate methods of determining your maximum heart rate and how to use heart rate monitors. I thought it was interesting that the first heart rate monitors used with modern athletes took place in 1976 in Finland. So they really haven't been around all that long. Obviously, they've been used in medical settings with patients and, you know, with different diseases and everything. But, you know, haven't been really used with athletes for all that long.
The Finns used to dominate Olympic running, didn't they?
Their athletics has always been very solid, whether it's cross-country skiing. Norway, Finland, a lot of those countries have really had some solid athletes over the years. So they were definitely pioneers in a lot of these fields. In fact, the Polar Electro Company was founded in the late 70s, and there are now many companies, you know, like Garmin, Soleus, Timex, Suunto, who make quality heart rate devices. We're actually going to include a link on our blog post with this podcast to some reviews of several top heart rate monitoring devices. You know, I'm not going to take time in the podcast to talk about each one because there's a number of different good devices, and you kind of have to weigh the pros and cons for yourself as far as for your needs.
So what do you think is the main benefit of using a heart rate monitor?
I think it's a really good way to gauge your fitness and performance. As you track your heart rate information with training, you're going to be able to see if you're making fitness gains or if you're overtraining and should back off some. For example, if you see that your heart rate is rising at all running speeds, even during easy runs, this is going to be a sign that you need to rest and not train. And by using a heart rate monitor, you'll gradually learn what heart rates you can sustain over time, and this is going to help you plan pacing during races.
So it's kind of a good way to know your body better.
Yeah, it really is. It's just kind of getting a look inside of your body at what's going on. If you're interested in using heart rate training, the first thing you'll need to do is to buy a heart rate monitor, and it usually consists of a watch and a chest strap with a sensor that tracks your pulse. There are some wrist models that kind of will do your radial pulse. And, you know, I'm sure as time goes on, those kind of models will become more accurate. But
yeah,
usually you'll just see the chest strap and the watch. And really, heart rate training is all about finding the right training zones for your body. It's a very individualized thing. So in order to figure out the right training zone, you're going to need to gather some data about yourself first.
So now we want to talk about calculating your heart rate training zones. And there's basically three methods that Angie's going to get into.
There's probably more methods than this, but I'm trying to simplify things.
Yes.
Like I said, this information can be entirely dizzying, and there's whole books written about each one of these separate topics. And if you find this really interesting, I would encourage you to get a book about it and study it further because, you know, there's really some great information and very helpful tools. But I want to try to distill it as the best I can. We've already talked a little bit about how the formula of 220 minus your age isn't really accurate. And so one of the biggest flaws of understanding and using heart rate training is that you may not be working from the right numbers. It's important that if you want to use heart rate training that you first establish what's called your maximum heart rate. A number that's more accurate even than your maximum heart rate would be called your heart rate reserve. So we're going to talk about how to find your maximum heart rate and then calculate your heart rate reserve from your maximum heart rate. The first and most accurate method to calculate your maximum heart rate is to go to an exercise laboratory and have an exercise physiologist perform a maximum exercise test. And this is usually done on a treadmill. The data gained from this test would include things like your maximum heart rate, your VO2 max, your lactate turn point, and maybe a few other details. This test usually involves running on a treadmill while you're hooked up to some machines, and it's going to monitor heart rate, blood pressure, and oxygen consumption. Every few minutes, the treadmill is going to get faster, and they're going to make the incline steeper until you reach your maximum effort, basically, until you can't go on. And then your heart rate at this maximum effort is going to be your maximum heart rate. So for all these tests that I'm going to talk about, the most accurate way to measure this is to go to an exercise laboratory and have an exercise physiologist do this test on you. But if you want to save the money, there are fairly accurate methods to do this at home. So we're going to talk about how to calculate your maximum heart rate on your own. And like we said, before you are going out and doing this test, make sure that you have a clean bill of health from your doctor, that your cardiac system is working well, because anytime you try to reach your maximum heart rate, you're putting stress on your heart. And, you know, we just don't want you doing this in an unsupervised setting and something bad happening. So just make sure that you have clearance to do this first. You can determine your maximum heart rate by doing a 2-mile time trial. And I'd recommend that you use a track or a flat stretch of road for this because you want a steady effort. Wear your heart rate monitor and run 1 mile easy to warm up. So very slow, very easy pace for the first mile. Then run 2 miles or 8 laps of the track at the fastest pace you can sustain, meaning that each lap should be about roughly the same pace. You don't want to get to the point where your legs are rubbery and shaking, but you want a hard, steady pace that you can maintain for 8 laps. Then look at the monitor later and see the maximum heart rate that was hit during these 8 laps. And this is going to be a good estimate of your maximum heart rate. So for example, when I did this test, my maximum heart rate was 184. So hold on to that number. Next, you're going to determine your resting heart rate. So each morning before you get out of bed, you're going to want to count your pulse for 60 seconds and record the number. You can do this in a relaxed setting. You can be sitting up. Just make sure it's fairly soon after you wake up, before you've had any coffee or tea or any other stimulants, and record your resting heart rate. Do this for 7 days and then average the numbers. And this would be your resting heart rate. And my resting heart rate is in the low 40s. So I'm going to say 45 just for the sake of calculation, since we're using my metrics here. Another note, as you get fitter, your resting heart rate is going to probably drop. So you should recheck your resting heart rate approximately once a month, just so you make sure that you're working from the right numbers. So your heart rate reserve is your maximum heart rate minus your resting heart rate. So remember, we had the 184 from my maximum heart rate. We're going to subtract 45 from that. So my heart rate reserve would be 139. So hold on to that number.
Got it.
It's very important to understand which numbers that you need to use before you start calculating your training zones. You need to know whether you're looking at your maximum heart rate, your lactate threshold, or something else, because if you use the wrong number, it's going to give you different results that may not be entirely accurate. So to calculate your heart rate for each zone, you do the following. Take your heart rate reserve times the percent you want to train at, and then add back in your resting heart rate. So maybe you've heard for an easy run, you should train at 65 to 75% of your maximum heart rate. So you take your heart rate reserve, which mine was 139, times 65%, that would be 90, and then you add back your resting heart rate in, which is 45, and you come up with 135 beats per minute in this case. And most of your training should be done in zone 2 to 3, where your body is building endurance and primarily burning fat. Interestingly enough, zone 3 is often the pace that you revert to in training runs without really thinking about it. So if you're just running and not thinking about it, you're probably in zone 3. Zone 4 is probably the pace that you're going to run races in. And zone 5, or this is also called the red zone, is where you go anaerobic. So your body is running out of oxygen, and it's really only possible for short periods of time. But it is valuable to do a little bit of training in zone 5 after you have a good endurance base, so that you can train your fast twitch muscle fibers and develop some speed.
And increase your anaerobic threshold.
Exactly. Now, there are entire books written about heart rate training. Like I said, you may want to invest in one of these. Joe Friel has Total Heart Rate Training, which is recommended. Rich Roll, in his book Finding Ultra, talks about training heart rate zones. Phil Moffitone has a book out. I believe Ben Greenfield is going to be releasing his book called Beyond Training in 2014, which covers a lot of these metrics and everything too. So like I said, you know, this is very interesting to learn about. Mm-hmm. So really read what information they want before you start calculating, because it could be wanting your maximum heart rate. It could be wanting your heart rate reserve. It could be wanting your lactate threshold, which we'll talk about later. So some charts like the Carvonin method are going to use your heart rate reserve to calculate your heart rate for each zone. There'll be some charts that will use your maximum heart rate. So you have to be really careful that you know, again, what numbers you're using. I found a website called DigiFit, and it compares actually 8 different scales. So
you got 8 different charts.
You got 8 different charts, 8 different, slightly different formulas. So, you know, and all of them have a varying degree of accuracy. So you really have to pick one, figure out what metrics that you need for it, and then follow that. You know, I don't recommend using ones that use the 220 minus age equals maximum heart rate. That doesn't take into account your resting heart rate, which can be widely variable. That one kind of assumes that your resting heart rate is going to be around 70. And for someone who has a really low heart rate, you know, like me in the 40s, it's not going to be give you accurate results.
Okay. So that's DigiFit.
Yes.
We'll link to that over on our site. Angie's copying and pasting right now.
Yes, because it's very important. The bottom line is that most of your training, no matter what chart you're using, should be done in zone 2 and 3, because this is where your body is building endurance and primarily burning fat. Interestingly enough, zone 3 is often the pace that you revert to in your training runs when you're not really thinking about it. Zone 4 is usually the zone where you run races in. And zone 5, also known kind of as the red zone, where you go anaerobic, is only possible for short periods of time. But it is valuable after you have your endurance base built to do some training in zone 5 so that you can improve your fast twitch muscle fibers and develop more speed. The main thing to know is that each of the zones, each of the charts, is basically going to be divided into zones 1 through 5. Some of them maybe go a little bit higher. And zone 1 is going to be your kind of your healthy heart rate target. it's going to be 60% of either your maximum heart rate or your heart rate reserve, whatever number you're looking at there. And this is going to be very comfortable and light activity. It's going to help you build basic endurance. You'll be able to talk easily while you're in this zone, and you know, things like walking, housework, maybe low impact aerobics, yoga, stuff like that will be in zone one. Now, zone two is more temperate. It would be 60 to 70%. And this is where you gain some of the greatest training benefits. It's still going to be fairly light exercise. It's been described as brisk but comfortable. Your breathing is going to be slightly more noticeable, but you're not going to be short of breath. Things like jogging, swimming, cycling. And when you're building your endurance base, you really need to be doing most of your training in zone two. And this is where the fat burning is really at its peak, is in zone two.
Our next episode, we talk to a guy who has won the most marathons of any person in the United States. And he's going to say that all his training he does pretty much with heart rate zones.
Yeah, a lot of very accomplished athletes use some sort of system of zone training. Now, zone three is going to be your aerobic zone. It's usually about 70 to 80%, and it produces some of the best physiological adaptations in the heart, your skeletal muscles, and your metabolism. So your effort's going to be somewhat hard here, but you're still able to talk, and it would include things like a faster pace of jogging, swimming, cycling, maybe using the stair stepper. This is also primarily a fat burning zone, although your body may dip into your glycogen or your carbohydrate stores at the upper end of this zone. And most of your training, like we talked about, should be in either zone two to three with the heart between 60 to 80%. Zone four is where you get up to your threshold, 80 to 90%. It's used mostly in training for high performance, 1 to 2 times per week for a duration of less than an hour. If you do too much training in zone four, you're probably going to be overtrained and start developing some problems. The effort is hard to very hard, and you're going to have heavier breathing, you know, faster heart rate. Examples would be faster running, spinning, cross-country skiing, things like that where you're really doing solid work. Now, zone five, the red line zone, be 90 to 100%. This should be used minimally for distances of about 400 meters or 2 to 4 minutes maximum, because this effort is very hard. You're going to have very heavy breathing. Your heart's going to feel like it's racing. You may use zone five some in racing, last sprint to the finish line, and in speed work intervals. So it's important that after you have a solid running base in zone two, that you can start training your fast twitch muscle fibers and working on building up your anaerobic threshold. But in the beginning, you don't want to be doing training at this level.
If you wanted to run a zone two, Angie, based on your metrics, you would try to get in like 111 to 129 beats per minute then.
Right, exactly. Based on using your maximum heart rate, it's important to kind of have these ideas in the back of your mind. There's also some watches where you can program your numbers in, and it'll start beeping at you if you're in the wrong zone.
Wow.
So it can give you a good reminder if you're wanting to do zone two training and you're getting out of the zone, then like, oh, dude, slow down. Or, you need to speed up because you're going too slow. So it can be helpful to have your technology give you a kick in the butt or slow you down a little bit too.
So that was how to find your heart rate training zone using maximum heart rate. Now we're going to talk about the Moffitone method.
Yes, another heart rate training guide that you may come across or hear people talk about is called the Moffitone method. And this is named after a scientist, author, and coach named Dr. Phil Moffitone.
And musician.
Yeah, he is a musician, kind of.
That's his new gig, isn't it?
Yeah, second career songwriter, musician. Very well-rounded individual, obviously.
He's a Renaissance man.
Definitely. He developed a formula for establishing the peak heart rate that you should achieve during the first 3 months of your training. So this is when you're going to be doing your base building effort. And one of his mantras was, speed up by slowing down. So to calculate your heart rate training zone for building your aerobic base, you want to do the following. Subtract your age from 180. So for me, I'm going to say I'm 35 because I will be in a couple of weeks. And 180 minus 35 would be 145. Then you subtract 10 if you're recovering from a major illness or a hospital visit, or if you're on regular medication for a chronic condition. You would subtract an additional 5 if you've not exercised before or if you're just beginning to rebuild your running base. If you have been exercising regularly without interruption, you don't have to subtract anything. If you've been training for more than 2 years without any of the problems listed above and you've made progress in competition without any injury, you can add 5. So you take the 180 minus your age, you have a number, and then you play around with it depending on you know, how you're doing. So I'm not going to add anything here or subtract anything. This number would represent your maximum heart rate to use for aerobic training to promote fitness gains while staying mostly in the fat burning zone. A training range from this heart rate of 10 beats below could be used as a training guide. So for example, I got 145. So the range for my heart rate would be 135 to 145. And this is going to provide a conservative guideline for a 3-month period of base training. He also recommends doing a maximum aerobic fitness test once a month to track your progress. So for this test, you're going to want to warm up with 10 minutes of easy walking or jogging, then run 1 mile at your maximum heart rate in zone 2. So for me, it was 145. So you would run 1 mile, not going above 145, record the time. Run a second mile at the maximum heart rate and record the time there. Finally, jog a 3rd mile at maximum heart rate and record. So you're doing these intervals here. The times from each mile should progressively get a little bit slower because your heart is already, you know, going to be warmed up. It's going to be harder and harder to keep your heart rate down the longer you go. If you do this test regularly, you can see how your aerobic endurance is increasing. So if you do that every month, you should notice that you're able to run the faster times while keeping your heart rate in the right zone, at zone 2. Now, some people get really frustrated because they find that their normal pace is outside of this endurance training zone. But lacking a solid aerobic base could be one reason why they're not experiencing fitness gains or they're struggling with overtraining syndrome. When I was researching this, an ultra runner and blogger named Wyatt Hornsby said about his experience of training by this method. He said, quote, "This is not to say going anaerobic is bad or going above this zone. Quite the contrary, it's essential to peak fitness, but it has to be done at the right time. When base building for the upcoming racing season, it's vital to first establish aerobic strength, which in turn will provide a solid foundation for some purposeful anaerobic strength building running later in your training. Without a solid aerobic base, doing anaerobic training is like, in essence, building a house on sand." End of quote. So I thought that was really good how he kind of wrapped it up. Yes, speed training is important, but you have to have that endurance base or it could all come tumbling down on you because you don't have the right level of endurance fitness. So if you want more information on the Moffitone method, you can check out his website, or his book is called The Big Book of Endurance Training and Racing.
And the third way of calculating your heart rate zone is the lactate threshold. Angie, I think I heard you say that you prefer this method. So what is it all about?
The method of calculating your heart rate training using the lactate threshold was developed by endurance sports coach and Training Peaks founder Joe Friel. And one of the most important reasons to know your lactate threshold is because it's above this point that you're going to start developing lactic acid buildup in your system. This is also known as your anaerobic threshold and point of deflection. So they're kind of all related to the same thing. But your lactate threshold is where your body is removing lactate as fast as it's being produced. When you reach the certain heart rate, the muscles switch from using fat as your primary source of energy to using stored muscle glycogen. And a byproduct of burning glycogen is lactic acid. And there's a point where your body can no longer remove the lactic acid from the muscles quickly enough. So once you're training in a higher zone, your body is going to start burning glycogen. When it burns glycogen, it produces lactic acid, and at some point, your body can't deal with it fast enough, and this is called your anaerobic threshold. And the good news is you can train your body to increase its anaerobic threshold. The most accurate method to measure this is by doing one of those laboratory tests that we talked about earlier. There's also a small portable device you can buy that analyzes lactate, and you basically carry it around during exercise and breathe into it, and it'll consistently monitor your lactic acid rates. But typically, most people are going to reach their anaerobic threshold somewhere in zone 4. Now, your running speed at lactate threshold is the best indicator of running fitness and endurance performance. Running speed at lactate threshold is the velocity at which lactate begins to accumulate dramatically in the blood. Essentially, the body gets backed up trying to remove all the lactate from your muscles. So lactate threshold is a moderately high running intensity, or the highest intensity that you can sustain without significant discomfort. So for example, if you're running below lactate threshold, your breathing is going to be controlled. But when you exceed the threshold, there's a sudden increase in your breathing rate. So we want to talk a little bit about how to test your lactate threshold now. We talked earlier about how the best place to get these tests done is in a lab. However, there are some formulas you can use to test your lactate threshold on your own, which will have some varying degrees of accuracy. The first one is called the running lactate threshold test. So on a day when you're feeling great, go to an athletic track, wear your heart rate monitor, and warm up with an easy 10 to 15 minute jog. Then you're going to run a 30 minute time trial where you run at a tempo you can sustain for 30 minutes, but not longer. So it'd probably be like an 8 on a scale of 1 to 10 in intensity, sort of like a 5K pace. You know, you're pushing, but you don't feel like you're going to die, that kind of thing. So you start your 30-minute time trial. At the 10-minute mark, click the lap button on your watch so you could note where you're going to begin calculating your average heart rate. Then when you're finished with a 30-minute time trial, look back over the results and note the average heart rate that you sustained during the last 20 minutes. This is going to be your lactate threshold heart rate for your run workouts, and it's going to correspond to your lactate threshold. Another way of determining your lactate threshold is to put on your heart monitor and to jog slowly for 2 to 3 minutes at a very easy pace. Then increase your pace moderately and sustain the new pace for 2 to 3 minutes. Continue this pattern where you run a little bit faster for 2 to 3 minutes and then run a little bit faster for 2 to 3 minutes. If you continue this pattern, note your heart rate at each new pace until you reach a pace where your breathing spikes up. This is going to be your lactate threshold. And a popular zone system uses this method that I'm going to talk about below. For me, I would push the lap button every time that I would pick up the pace a little bit so I could see when I look back on my Garmin data where I was, you know, trying to run a new pace. Anyway, for me, this took place at about a heart rate of 162. And so that would make my running speed at lactate threshold around an 8:15 pace because I was running about an 8:15 pace when my heart rate hit 162. So obviously, if I want to run a Boston qualifying time, I need to run approximately a 3:40 marathon. And so I would need to run about an 8:12 pace for the whole marathon. If my lactate threshold is going to kick in about 8:15, obviously there's going to be a problem there. I'm not going to be able to sustain that pace. So that means I need to work on increasing my lactate threshold in my training. And again, this is a metric that you need to reevaluate every 3 months or so, because as you become fitter, it's going to change, hopefully for the better. So the first zone that specifically deals with lactate threshold is called zone 1. It's active recovery, and it would be less than 80% of your lactate threshold heart rate. So, you know, for me, again, it was 162 was my lactate threshold heart rate, so I'm working from that. In zone 1, this is a very easy zone. It would include things like easy aerobic training that stimulates your blood circulation, but is not going to be strenuous at all. In fact, they find that really easy exercise after strenuous work can help speed recovery because it's increasing your circulation enough to help remove inflammation and increase tissue healing, but it's not enough that's going to tax your body. So, for example, maybe an easy yoga class or some light stretching, an easy swim or a bike ride, walking the dog, things like that would be considered zone 1. So for me, zone 1 would be less than a heart rate of 129. And everyone's is going to be a little bit different depending on what your lactate threshold heart rate is. Moving on to zone 2, this is going to be 81 to 89% of your lactate threshold heart rate. And it's going to be an easy conversational effort. This is where you can, you know, carry on a conversation pretty easily, but you're still, you know, doing some work here. This primarily uses your slow twitch muscle fibers, and this should be the intensity of most of your training, especially when you're building your base. This intensity is really important for training because the body can learn to use fat as fuel and conserve your carbohydrate stores, especially for events that are lasting more than 2 hours. So if you're doing a long run or you're training for a marathon, you need to learn how to run in zone 2 so that you can conserve your energy stores for as long as possible. Now, if you're going to use the long, slow aerobic method of training, that's your zone 2 and not your zone 3. And many athletes make the mistake of doing most of their training in zone 3. Like I said, it's really easy to revert to that zone if you're not careful. And, you know, unless you're watching your heart rate, it's easy just to jump out of zone 2 into zone 3. For me, it felt really slow, really easy. And it was kind of like, wow, I hardly ever run at this pace. So it was kind of interesting to test that out. For me, the lactate threshold heart rate was about 131 to 144 in zone 2. Now, zone 3 would be 90 to 95% of your lactate threshold heart rate. And your body here is still primarily functioning aerobically, and burning in the legs and shortness of breath is really minimal. You'll still feel like you're working, but it's not really stressing your body too much. If you do spend too much time in this zone, it's going to provide too much stimulation of the slow twitch muscle fibers. And as the intensity increases from zone 2 to 3, there's going to be some oxygen debt that's going to build up, and the body will switch from burning mostly fat to burning carbs. So it's going to tap into your glycogen stores. Many athletes find this is kind of the sweet spot for distance races. It allows you to go relatively fast without dipping too much into your carbohydrate stores. This is why long interval training sessions or doing things like hill repeats can be really good, because it's going to help you prepare for that race pace. And I thought it was interesting, too, that this is the zone where it's high enough you can get that psychological runner's high. I think that's why a lot of people tend to revert to zone 3, because their body instinctively knows it's going to feel really good if you run in this zone. And usually it's in somewhere in zone 3 that that runner's high kicks in for most people. However, if you do all your training in zone 3 or above, that intensity is going to wear the body down after so many miles, and you know, you probably won't get significantly faster. So for example, for me, zone 3, my heart rate would be 146 to 154. So there'll be a specific range that you should shoot for as you're, you know, watching your heart rate on your monitor.
And you're going to want to train in zone 3 on tempo days, is that what you're saying?
Tempo days, yes. You know, some interval sessions. Probably when you're going to be running up a hill, you'll be more in zone 3, maybe a little bit in zone 4, depending on how steep it is.
So hill work and speed work, basically.
Exactly. Zone 4 is called sublactate threshold pace. It would be 96 to 99% of your lactate threshold heart rate. And lactate threshold is also called anaerobic threshold, which we talked about earlier. And this is the highest intensity at which your body can recycle the lactic acid as quickly as it's produced. At this intensity, you're still working very hard, but you can maintain your maximum sustainable pace in good form, because the lactic acid levels in the blood and muscles are steady and they're not increasing. So your body is able to clear the lactic acid as fast as it's being built up at your lactate threshold. Now, if you increase the intensity toward the higher end of zone 4 and above, it's going to cause lactic acid to accumulate more rapidly, and then you're going to start having the problems with muscle fatigue, maybe cramping, heavy legs, rubbery legs, that kind of thing. If you stay too much in zone 4, especially during training, this is going to bring premature fatigue, and it's going to delay your recovery because there's going to be acidic hydrogen ion buildup and more rapid carbohydrate depletion. However, it's important to perform some interval training sessions near lactate threshold to teach your body to decrease the amount of lactic acid being produced by the fast-twitch muscle fibers and to burn more lactic acid by the slow-twitch fibers at this intensity. So if you can raise your lactic acid threshold, it's going to allow you to work harder at a higher intensity. And since you're not doing all-out speed work, you can recover from the zone fairly quickly if you go to doing zone 2 work as your next workout or taking a rest day. Now, zone 4 training can give you a lot of bang for your buck, but when you start to experience kind of the rubbery legs like I talked about, a noticeable increase in breathing, or you have trouble keeping good running form, this is the point where the lactic acid is starting to accumulate too fast in your legs to be removed. And this is going to really decrease your ability to maintain a steady effort, and you're going to need a longer recovery time. So if you stay at or just below your lactate threshold, you're really going to work on building up your lactate threshold, and it's good speed work zone. However, if you go too far above that, it kind of slows down your recovery time, and you really don't do too much good, especially in longer sessions. So zone 4 training is good for like 1 to 7 minute intervals, and then you're going to want to take a rest interval afterward. So, you know, maybe do like 4 minutes in zone 4 and then do 2 minutes in zone 2. You know, 4 minutes in zone 4, 2 minutes in zone 2, something like that. So you're alternating, giving your body a chance to rest, your heart rate to recover, things like that. The next zone is called zone 5A through 5B. This is where you're going to exceed your lactate threshold and your body is relatively stressed. This would be about 100 to 105% of your lactate threshold heart rate. The lactic acid is going to build up really quickly, and this intensity can't be sustained for long periods. Now, it's useful for like a surge in a race, maybe somewhere up to 5 minutes if you're well trained, because you're still getting some aerobic energy from your oxygen and everything. But there's a lot of muscle and joint impact when you stay in this zone because of the higher levels of lactic acid, and it's going to take a lot of recovery. So, you know, it can be great for a race if you need to surge past someone or do a fast finish. But if you do a lot of work in this zone, especially in your training, then it's going to take a long time to recover from it, and you may not see the progress in your speed like you want to. Typically, the only work done in this zone is interval training and hill repeats. It can be good for maybe 2 to 5 minute intervals, and you're going to want to use a 1-to-1 ratio of zone 5 to zone 2 or complete rest in between. So for example, my heart rate at this point would be 162 to 170. Finally, go to zone 5C, and this is called your anaerobic capacity. And anaerobic means in the absence of oxygen. This would be greater than 106% of your lactate threshold heart rate. So the intensity of this zone is primarily training your glycolytic and your phosphagenic energy systems. And it can involve sets of anywhere from about 5 seconds up to a couple minutes in duration. Athletes who want to develop their fast twitch muscle fibers or work on their strength and explosive power, whether it's cycling or running, should do occasional sessions in zone 5C. These type of workouts should be really short, explosive, followed by long recoveries. They would include things like powerlifting, some weight training, plyometrics, and short bursts of hard running. And so for me, my heart rate in this zone would be greater than 171.
Yeah, you think about those elite runners who are, you know, winning marathons and competing on the elite level, how our zone 5 would be like their zone 2. You
know? Right, exactly. Yeah, I noticed recently in New York City, they have a treadmill set up with like a harness system. Mm-hmm. And just people can see how long they can sustain Ryan Hall's marathon pace, which is, you know, low 5-minute miles.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting, you know, to see how long you could do that. They have like this harness set up. So if you fall off the treadmill, you know, it's going to catch you.
Oh, I see. So they had the treadmill like going as fast as
exactly to see how at. Yeah, how fast you can keep up with it.
I need to see that.
You know, some people could maybe keep up for a minute or, you know, maybe a mile or two. But, wow. You know, running a whole marathon at that pace, that would be pretty amazing, because you see them, you know, on TV or on clips on YouTube, you know, doing their marathons. It just looks so smooth and effortless.
Right.
But yeah, you know, we would look like we were being chased by
hyenas,
but you know, it would be horrible to try to run that fast. And so, you know, primarily endurance runners work mostly on their slow twitch muscle fibers because they need the endurance. But they're also going to do some explosive, high-intensity work in these higher zones so that they can have that final kick. And they're going to have those fast-twitch muscle fibers to recruit when they need, you know, they need them during a race to pass somebody or to finish strong. If you were a sprinter, obviously you're going to work more on your fast-twitch muscle fibers and you're not going to do as much of the endurance work.
Right. So what are some limitations to heart rate and zone training?
Well, we want to point out that just using a heart rate monitor and training this way is not going to automatically make your training more effective. There's actually a few mistakes that people make, and there's some factors why your heart rate can vary for a given intensity. Things like dehydration can increase your heart rate by about 7.5%. Heat and humidity can also increase your heart rate by about 10 beats per minute. Altitude can increase your heart rate by 10 to 20%, even when you're acclimatized to whatever elevation you're at. So I thought that was really interesting. And biological variations like stress, your hormone levels from day to day can even change your heart rate from 2 to 4 beats per minute. So, you know, your heart rate is only one part of the equation. There's many different factors that go into it. So you kind of have to look at it long term and not just get worked up over one day's results. And there's a few heart rate training mistakes that a person wants to avoid. I've mentioned this a couple times, but just don't use that 220 minus age formula. I think it's more accurate to figure out your maximum heart rate, your resting heart rate, and your lactate threshold. And so once you figure out your lactate threshold, most of your training should be performed below this zone, and you should only go above your lactate threshold in maybe 1 to 2 short speed sessions a week. So okay. Make sure you're training in the right zones, basically. The second thing is heart rate monitors can be fairly inaccurate during shorter speed workouts. So when you suddenly increase your running intensity, there's something called cardiac lag that takes place. During fast intervals, your heart rate may continue climbing even after you're doing a recovery lap. So it kind of takes a while for the heart rate monitor to catch up, and your heart rate is still going to be up for maybe a couple minutes after you finished, depending on how fast you went. So it's best to use your pace and your perceived effort to help regulate the intensity in those shorter speed sessions with things like strides or 400 to 800 meter repeats. So, you know, you should use your heart rate monitor as a guide, but not get too worked up. Be like, oh no, I went above my lactate threshold, you know, because it'll probably come down. Just, you know, take another lap and let things calm down before you go into another interval. The third thing is that heart rate monitoring only provides one part of the total exercise intensity equation. For example, most runners will have a lower heart rate while running on a treadmill than they do while running outdoors at the same pace. Now, this doesn't mean that running on the treadmill is easier. In fact, the opposite is true. Studies have shown that runners feel better and can run faster outdoors, even though their heart rates may be higher outdoors. Also, there's things like dehydration, heat, humidity, stress levels, allergies, illness, pain, even certain medications that you take that can skew the numbers that you see on the monitor. If you're overanalyzing and stressing out about one day's workout, you may not get the accurate picture. And so you should probably look at heart rate training more like week to week, month to month, that type of thing. You kind of have to be in it for the long haul and see trends that are going to, you know, come up. So in conclusion, hopefully we didn't lose you on that lactate threshold zone chart because it can be pretty, you know, dizzy in some of the details. I think it's really awesome that we have so much technology at our disposal. Maybe you really like numbers and data, and it's important for you to know your precise lactate threshold and your VO2 max. On the other hand, maybe you don't really care, and the thought of all this stresses you out. You may never purchase a heart rate monitor or high-tech watch, and really, that's fine. Realize that all these systems are simply guides to improve your endurance and your enjoyment of running. If you find yourself stressing out about zones during every single second of your workout and boring random strangers with all the details, then maybe it's time to unplug yourself and just listen to your body. Take a run that's without your watch, that's totally unplugged once in a while. Running should be adding to our enjoyment, not causing a great amount of stress. And I think the neat thing is that running is what we make it. You can choose to let running enrich your life as you learn to appreciate what your body is capable of accomplishing. And I think that should be the goal for all of us.
And you might need to go back and listen to this again just to really get it down. I know I'm going to have to. And we're also going to put a lot of Angie's notes over on the blog. So her notes with all of the references that she drew from for this episode will be over there. Angie, thank you for putting this together. I can't say that I understand it all after this one go-round here, but I'm closer than I was.
I think it's something that's hard to wrap your head around, but I really encourage people to study it a little bit more and try to figure out your different numbers. And for me, it kind of really clicked when I noticed when I was trying to figure out my lactate threshold. It was like, wow, yeah, my body does feel different at this pace. And it's like, oh my goodness, this is kind of revolutionary. That if I try to do this pace during a whole marathon, I'm going to crash and burn. So I think these numbers can be really helpful. Don't stress out about it. That's the main thing. Just take time to educate yourself if this is something you're interested in. Work with a running coach. There's a lot of great resources out there, a lot of great books. And yeah, like you said, you know, go over the show notes and, you know, figure out if this kind of stuff is something you want to pursue.
So now we want to talk about a website for this episode's quick tip. The site is called runninginTheUSA.com, and it is a massive directory of races and running clubs. And we're talking about races from all sizes, like from a 5K all the way up to ultras, Running in the USA. And we've never talked about it on the podcast before. So what do you like about this site, Angie?
Yeah, this is kind of a new find for me. And as you know, I'm kind of a marathon guide junkie. Yeah. I'm always on there looking for races. And so when we found this one, I thought there were some really cool features about it that was fairly unique. There is something called the 50 Staters gadget, and there's options to finding races by different lengths of races, by regions, by states, by weekends, day of the week.
So tell me about the 50 Staters gadget.
So here on the 50 Staters gadget, you can look for, let's say, marathons only. You can look for halves and fulls. You can look for ultras. You can look for 5Ks, 10Ks. And then you can put in, like, a distance between cities that you want to search for the races. Or you can put in regions. Or you can select one specific state. And then it's going to show you all the races, you know, in that region, whatever parameters that you set in.
And it sort of groups them together. So
right.
If you have a weekend and you need to knock out some states in the Midwest, you can just insert those settings and it will group the races together according to like how far apart they are and time and distance, right?
Exactly. So, for example, you know, I put in marathons only, miles between cities and put in the state of Missouri, and it's going to show me in October all the marathons in Missouri.
So we could have done Waddell and Reed in Kansas City on the 19th, and then
the Des Moines Marathon, which would be
180 miles.
Yeah.
On
the next day.
On Sunday, yeah.
And then, you know, the 26th, we could have done the Shawnee Marathon, and then we could have done Rock and Roll St. Louis. So, you know, if you're trying to plan, like, a vacation or marathon weekend, or let's say you just want to take, like, 2 weeks off and do as many races as you can.
Right.
You know, some people will try to hit several states, especially if they have to fly out there. There's some just really great tools to use on this site that I thought were kind of fun.
Yeah, so go nuts and try to run two marathons in a weekend, or get a bunch of states under your belt, or just go find a 5K that you didn't know existed over at runninginTheUSA.com. If you don't live in the United States, we recommend marathonguide.com, which we've talked about on the show before. We also hope that you come over and check out our website at marathontrainingacademy.com. We have links to our podcast episodes, blog posts, as well as training plans and other resources that we have. And when you are on our website, you can download a free audio gift called The 7 Pillars of Successful Marathon Training. Thank you for listening to this episode. We want you to know you have what it takes to run a marathon and change your life.
Well on my way, well on my way. Oh, wait.